King Henry III was a dreamer. He dreamed of the glorious tales of previous kings of England, both ancient and contemporary. His younger years had seen him dream of being like Edward the Confessor, a pious and most Christian monarch. Then he dreamed of being like his uncle, Richard Coeur de Lion, bravely striding distant realms and bringing holy war to the Muslims in exotic Outremer. And he also dreamed of his grandfather, Henry, the mighty founder of the Plantagenet dynasty, who ruled more of France than any king of France, and who was the most powerful monarch in Europe. Henry III dreamed such grand dreams. And yet, he was merely a man. A man with limitations and weaknesses, forever starved of cash, forever having to compromise and bargain with his nobles, utterly self-absorbed and unable to either see the larger picture or even grasp the reality of the world around him. He was petulant and prone to bouts of fury and frustration. He was ultimately an incredibly petty man. Despite his dreams, his reality was a land stricken by seemingly endless financial woes, which led to draconian policies to cover this deficit that then left his subjects being basically fleeced for cash constantly. And right now, his was a nation stricken by famine and death. Thousands were starving, and the king was delivering not a dream, but a nightmare. Hi, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to the ongoing tale of this amazing city. We have reached the year round about 1258, and after several chapters where I've documented in detail the endless dance of politics between the crown and the city, it's time for things to start to come to a head. And this is one of those episodes where the events of one year take up an entire chapter. It's time to detail the reaction against this king. Welcome then to chapter 95 of The Story of London, The Ambiguity of the Nightmare King. Of all the follies of Henry II, one stands greatest of all, and that was his dreams of foreign adventures. He clearly wished to emulate his ancestors in bestriding the world in great glory. His father had died when he was a child. He never really knew the man, nor knew his uncle, King Richard, nor his mighty grandfather, Henry II. It's clear he wished desperately to emulate these close relatives of his, whose ghosts haunted his adult life. For decades, the king had been seemingly motivated by the shade of his grandfather. Henry III had been driven by the desire to reclaim the massive empire of Henry II. And these were not just idle hopes. His entire foreign policy had been dictated towards weakening France so as to gain land at their expense. And therefore, he allied with the Holy Roman Empire so as to aid him in this impossible-to-gain dream. His sister had married a Holy Roman Emperor. His younger brother had just been elected King of the Germans. But then, around 1250, he had taken the cross, and his focus had changed somewhat. Suddenly, he wished to emulate his uncle, Richard. He looked with envy upon King Louis of France, sailing to the kingdoms of Outremer, and easily able to raise a fortune in monies to facilitate this. Henry decorated his palaces with paintings of Richard the Lionheart fighting a supposed duel with Salah ad-Din. He genuinely imagined the glory that would be showered upon the House of Plantagenet by reviving its crusading traditions. Unfortunately, Henry's fanciful crusading plans still had to compete with his real obligations down in Gascony, and that devoured his time and, most importantly, what money he could raise. Although he had amassed plenty of coin through clerical taxation, By 1255, almost all the money he had raised had been sunk into restoring order in Gascony, following the calamitous De Montfort years. Yet the king's crusading ambition remained great, and this is what led him, we think, to leap at the chance to kind of combine these two aspects of his dreams. And he focused upon Sicily. You see, around 1254, Pope Innocent IV began to offer the technically vacant, but it's complicated, crown of Sicily to the princes of Europe, claiming that as he was overall feudal overlord of the island, he could give away the crown to whomever he wished. Henry of England leapt at the opportunity. See, Sicily had family connections. His aunt, Joan, daughter of Henry II, had been Queen of Sicily back in the 1180s, and had ended up being imprisoned there back in the 1190s. In chapter 76, I mentioned how her brother, Richard the Lionheart, had freed her during his journey east to the Third Crusade. But in doing this, Richard had then conquered the island to teach his ruler a lesson, and ever since then, the vast island to the south of Italy had been a pawn in the endless struggles between the popes and the emperors of the Holy Roman Empire. So with this in mind, Henry decided in 1254 to request that the crown of Sicily should be given to his second son, Edmund. And the Pope was happy, provided, you know, Henry III agreed to pay for it. And Henry saw a chance to emulate his grandfather. He could have a Plantagenet dynasty once again holding pan-European enclaves of power. And thus, he agreed to pay for it. And had he been like his grandfather, maybe the king could have made it work. But he wasn't. He was a naive fantasist who ignored pragmatic issues. What pragmatic issues? Well, for example, 2 years earlier, his own younger brother, Richard, the Earl of Cornwall, who at this stage in our story is King of the Germans, had actually been offered the crown of Sicily by a papal nuncio, and his reply to that representative of Rome had been, quote, "You might as well say I will sell you the moon. Climb up and take it," unquote. You see, I may have failed to mention that the Pope was not actually in charge of Sicily at the time. Perhaps I should have pointed out that detail from the small print. Yes, the Pope was offering Sicily to the person who would fight for Sicily for him. You get a sanctioned war, not like a proper crusade, but sort of like one. And if you couldn't physically get your soldiers there, the Pope would supply the troops. All you needed to do was, you know, supply the cash. And that's what Henry III agreed to do. He would pay the Pope to go and take Sicily, and then the Pope would give the throne of Sicily to his son Edmund, and all would be awesome. And so, on October 1255, the king announced to the Parliament that because of this agreement with the Pope, he happened to owe His Holiness some money. How much money? Oh, just 135,541 marks of silver, which wasn't so much slightly beyond his budget as more in a galaxy far, far away from it. Okay, said the king, but wait until you hear what we get for this, he tried to justify. So, for the bargain price of 135,541 marks of silver, Henry said, this would fund a great big army, who would march through France to Sicily, then use the passes over the Alps, which his in-laws, the Savoyards, controlled, see, forward thinking, and then they'd march all the way down into southern Italy, and from there a huge fleet would carry this awesome army over to the island of Sicily, and then they would fight and win. How awesome is that? Oh, and, the king went on to explain, Parliament kind of had to pay for this because Henry had also agreed that if he defaulted on this obligation, England would kind of be placed under an interdict and he'd personally been excommunicated. So, yeah, the whole scheme was positively insane. And yet Henry was all excited about his new cause. He made a great show of the official announcements about the idea. He accepted Sicilian clergy into England in preparation for the glorious victories to come. When his brother Richard was made King of Germany, he went on about how the Germans would help him. In March 1257, Henry presented his 12-year-old son Edmund, supposedly now or soon to be King of Sicily, to the assembled lords and barons in full kingly cosplay. How did folks react to this? Well, Matthew Paris, the contemporary chronicler of the time, was brutally honest. Quote, "The nobility of the kingdom grieved at being reduced to such ruin by the supine simplicity of one man," unquote. By 1258 then, away from London, the barons and magnates of the realm were fundamentally insisting they would not pay towards such an insane scheme, endlessly pointing out just how bad it was, and getting stressed that representatives of the Pope were turning up and effectively saying, "In nomine Patri, et Spiritus Sancte, where's my money? Where's my money?" The state coffers, said Parliament, were empty. The king's relatives, the Lusignan family, were utterly loathed and detested by all, and were getting any excess cash go to them. And above all, now he was facing England being placed under an interdict because he made a promise he had no way of ever fulfilling. There was a war on in Wales, and the crown was losing that. It was clear to the nobles of England this king was having issues. And in fact, the king was having issues. The year before, we read that, quote, "The king was overcome with grief at the frequent successes of the Welsh, and at the slaughter of so many of his liege subjects in the confines of Wales, and also at the thought of having been defrauded for the kingdom of Sicily, for which he had expended so much money to no purpose. Again, his grief was increased by the severe illness of the queen and the death of his daughter Catherine. This accumulation of sorrows brought on a tertian fever, which detained him for a long time at London, whilst at the same time the queen was confined to her bed at Windsor by an attack of pleurisy," unquote. The image we get is one of a king who clearly feels that control is slipping away from him. And events in London didn't help. We know in 1257, on top of all the stuff I mentioned last chapter of what was going on in London, something else went down. A man working for William de Valence, the chief of the Lusignans and the king's brother-in-law, was killed in a fight in London. And this was really bad news for the city. The story goes, quote, "The squire in the service of William de Valence, the king's brother, behaved with such great insolence at London, and drawing his dagger, swore he would dip it in the blood of the citizens. Putting his threats into execution, he wounded some of them without any reason, and after inflicting the wounds, gave utterance to such insults and threats, trusting to the usual protection of his lord," unquote. Oh dear, well, this is London in 1257. What can I say? A light blue touch paper and, quote, "The lower orders of citizens, however, rushed on him in crowds, being neither able nor willing to put up with this arrogance, and attacking him with stones and staves, put him to death," unquote. So, a man working for the king's favourite relative had just been murdered on the streets of London. Oh, this was bad. London braced itself for a terrible retribution. The account goes, quote, "When William heard of this circumstance, he laid a complaint against the citizens of London before the king, and in order to arouse his anger, had the dead body of the man brought before him. The mayor of the city was then sent for," unquote. So Mayor Ralph Hardell was summoned before the king and his favourite and detested brother-in-law, and a dead body was lying on the floor, and he was, quote, "severely called to account," unquote. However, Ralph Hardell had an ace up his sleeve and simply said, quote, "My lord king, I cannot check the violence of the lower orders of the citizens, but ask what the man said at the point of death," unquote. And why did Mayor Hardell say that? Well, the London mob who beat the crap out of this squire apparently had not killed him there and then. He'd been carried somewhere, grievously injured. And according to everyone who was there, who just so happened to be Londoners, it must be said, they said that many witnesses had all heard the squire's final dying words. What were they? Quote,
For God's sake, let my lord be told that my death is not to be imputed to anyone's fault. But it is only attributable to myself and to my folly and insolence. For we, trusting to the protection of our Lord and Master, have piteously trampled down the innocent as well as the guilty.
Unquote. Yeah, no, I'm going to say here and now, in no way did this guy say those things before he died. But in no way was anyone turning up before the king with Mayor Hardell going to say he didn't. I like to picture the scene. So there's this dead body of this rather bulgy French squire, literally beaten to death by both bricks and 2x4s wielded by a bunch of Londoners. And before the king stands the mayor and a bunch of Londoners, looking all concerned and saying, well, he did say he had it coming, Your Majesty. We all heard him. What could the king do? Call them all liars? Well, he could, but as we'd seen in previous episodes, legal cases where the king called Londoners a bunch of liars had all ended up being sided against him. The account says, quote, when the king learned the whole facts of the matter, he said, the offender only received what he deserved. But the remnants of ill feeling against the citizens were not entirely got rid of, unquote. Yeah, could have told you that was going to happen. So, we now arrive in the year 1258. And this year promised bad tidings. Accounts say the new year began with England being hit by, quote, the scarcity of money, the spoliation practiced by King and the Pope in England brought on unusual poverty. The land lay uncultivated, and great numbers of people died from starvation, unquote. Over the Christmas and New Year festival, quote, the price of a measure of wheat rose to 10 shillings. Apples were scarce, pears more so, figs, beechnuts, cherries, plums, in short, all fruits which are preserved in jars were completely spoiled, unquote. This was the nightmare made real. People were dying, food prices were skyrocketing, and as I mentioned at the end of last episode, there was graft in London, but this time being inflicted upon them by the king's agents. Accounts say it was around now that, quote, the citizens of London, of the middle and lower orders, made a serious complaint to the king that those appointed to collect the money for rebuilding the walls of the city, as the king had ordered for their honour, had fraudulently kept the greatest part of money in their own purses, to the injury of the citizens. Of this they were accused and proved guilty. However, their lives were spared, after great difficulty, on the intercession of John Mansell. But they were obliged to pay a ransom for themselves, unquote. As that winter of early 1258 dragged its weary way along, the tensions between Crown and City carried on amidst nationwide tension. But we must say that the Londoners, while they're the focus of our story, and while I make no bias of me favouring them, they could also be guilty of acts of pettiness, horror and graft themselves. Matthew Paris records that in early 1258, quote, whilst an extraordinary famine was prevailing to such a degree that numbers pined away in themselves and died, about 50 large ships from the continent, having been sent by Richard, King of Germany, laden with corn, wheat and bread, arrived at London. A proclamation was then made by royal authority, forbidding any of the citizens of London to buy any corn for storing up, with the view of selling it at a dearer price for those wanting it, as they had made a general practice of doing. Indeed, the said citizens were notorious for having, in time of want, either treacherously sent ships away laden with provisions, or for having purchased their cargoes entirely, in order to sell them at pleasure to those requiring such articles of consumption, unquote. Yeah, so, you know, our residents of London could be complete gits. And this could explain away a later entry that says, quote, the citizens of London, having been accused to the king of some irregularities, were punished in manifold ways and compelled to ransom themselves. Yet even after so doing, they had great difficulty in regaining the king's favour. The chief amongst them, Ralph Hurdle, who was mayor of the city, died of grief, unquote. Now, I will insert in the story, there is an issue about who actually was mayor of London right now. We know that during 1257 and 1258, Ralph Hurdle had been mayor. And we know that at some point, a man called William FitzRichard was appointed by the king to run the city. And the exact timing seem unsure, as some sources claim he took over the year before, after that grand jury-type investigation had been inflicted upon the city, which we covered last chapter. But for me, the case of the murdered squire I mentioned earlier, and this note by Matthew Paris, lends me to believe that Hurdle had held power until 1258, wherein he may have died, possibly, one wonders, from the stress of dealing with the endless, merciless attacks upon the city from the king, and that William FitzRichard was appointed until the pepperer John Gisors was made mayor. And Gisors is one of the few pepperers left in London who supplied the royal court with significant amounts of spices at this time, and he was part of the pro-royalist faction. So London was being led by those who tended to side with the king this year. But going forward, events outside of the city took hold, as following the famine, disease came in its wake. Quote, an awful and intolerable pestilence attacked the people, especially those of the lowest order, and spread death amongst them in a most lamentable degree. In the city of London, 15,000 of the poor had already perished. In fact, famine prevailed in England to such a great extent that many thousand human beings died of hunger, for the crops only arrived at maturity so late in the autumn in consequence of the heavy rains that the harvest was only got in by All Saints' Day in several parts of the kingdom, and a measure of corn was sold for 16 shillings, unquote. Enough of this. It was time for someone to change things. And London witnessed the start of this just down the road at Westminster. Early in the morning of the 30th of April, 1258, a large body of nobles, knights and their followers approached the King's Hall at the Palace of Westminster. They were not dressed in fine silks or hearty woolen court garments. They wore armour, and the sounds of their metallic dress mixed with the clanking of their deadly swords at their sides. These men were dressed for a fight. Leading this delegation were four powerful nobles: Peter of Savoy, the Queen's uncle; Richard de Clare, the Earl of Gloucester; Roger Bigod, the Earl of Norfolk; and Simon de Montfort, the Earl of Leicester. Around mid-morning, the body arrived at the King's Court in Westminster, and, quote, they placed their swords before the entrance of the King's Hall, and appearing before the King, saluted him as their Lord King in devoted manner, with fitting honour, unquote. These men did not walk in on him armed. This was no rebellion. They spoke like loyal men of the kingdom. Henry III, however, could not ignore the fact that even with their arms at the door, they were dressed for battle. One account says the king asked them, what is this, my lords? Am I, wretched fellow, your humble captive? To this the Earl of Norfolk is said to have replied, no, but let the wretched Potovins and all aliens flee from your face. These men had turned up to deal with the easiest of the issues around the king to deal with, the influence of the Lusignans, a.k.a. the Potovins. In that statement, it was clear that these men had had enough. These beloved parasitical Frenchmen had become a symbol for all that was wrong with the king's rule. They had to go. King Henry may have been shocked at this demand, but he could not have been surprised. The Lusignans were hated by basically everyone, and some historians maintain that those four knights stood there before him because they had the support of his own queen. This is how it was going to have to be. Roger Bigod, however, had only just started. Bigod went on to tell the king that the magnates of the land had all agreed. The king must swear to obey their advice, that both the king and his son, Lord Edward, would agree right now to swear on the Gospels that they would abide by the rulings of 24 barons, half elected by the king, we'll give him that, and half by the magnates. He had to agree that he was not to attempt to impose any more taxes, and Henry had to agree to hand over the royal seal, the ultimate tool of government, to a responsible person whose identity would be decided by the 24. Added to this, this body of 24 knights was then to elect a continual ruling council of 15 of the great and good of the land to guide the king in matters of day-to-day governance of the state. And finally, that the parliament was to meet 3 times a year with power to appoint royal ministers. In effect, Henry III was being told rulership of England was being taken from him. There was literally nothing he could do in the face of this. Here and now, he's lost. He and his son swore on the Gospels to obey these demands, and yet, like his father had facing the barons at Runnymede the generation before, Henry had 2 crucial advantages: the majesty of his status and time. Even though he capitulated, even though England was now once again to be run by committee, he still had time to bring forth grand ideas. This time he dreamed that he could use his power to appoint the half of the committee of 24 that he was to appoint. He wanted to fill it with Lusignans and their supporters. But 8 weeks later, even he couldn't ignore the truth. He could not even find a dozen men who would still support his personal reign. And as such, 2 months later, at Oxford, Parliament met. And at this meeting, the town was filled with heavily armed knights. Now, supposedly, they were all armed, as normally this force was to have a Parliament and then march from Oxford to Wales, there to prosecute the ongoing war with the Welsh. But in reality, everyone was armed in case this meeting was to end in a full-blown civil war. It's easy when studying the history of the next few years to see this meeting in Oxford as a moment where the barons were all sure about what they were about to do, and what followed was part of some grand scheme. Do not believe that. The king was a fantasist and a bit of an idiot, but he was still king, and the barons and nobles were deeply unsure if what they were planning would work. But once the meeting started, King Henry's resistance to reality finally collapsed. He was confronted with a litany of his failings and was accused of failing to observe the Magna Carta. King Henry and his son Edward agreed to take another oath to abide by the barons' reforms, and the only opposition at that parliament came from the Lusignans themselves, who responded angrily to demands for them to give up their lands and castles awarded to them by the king. These objections were met with a brutal response. Supposedly, Simon de Montfort confronted William de Valence personally at the meeting and said, quote, "Know for certain and make no mistake about it. You will either give up the castles which you hold of the king, or you will lose your head," unquote. Horrified at this, the Lusignans fled Oxford to the safety of the Diocese of Winchester, which one of the de Valence brothers held. Yet, despite the king agreeing to their demands, there was a vast uncertainty within the barons' ranks. The king had agreed, but this again was a new thing. This whole thing was new. There were no rules for this. All of this was coming down to personalities. With the strong personality of de Valence and his kin having fled Oxford, Matthew Paris tells us that this great meeting of Parliament ended, quote, "uncertainty and inconclusively," unquote. The barons were not just focused upon central government, but also on corruption out in the shires. Overall, these measures were eventually known as the Provisions of Oxford, and they allowed for four knights in each county to investigate abuses by royal officials and establish methods of redress and much more. Regardless of what you call it, in the end it was a coup d'etat, and power needs someone to wield it. And the brother of the Duke of Norfolk, Hugh Bigod, was appointed justiciar by the magnates. For some, this was a godsend. Finally, someone seemed to be dealing with the ineptitude and foolishness of this nightmare king and his follies. However, many others were deeply disturbed. For all the difficulties of the personality of the king, for all the problems he may cause, the issue with this solution was that it usurped the order of things. In a world filled with famine and disease, and with a bunch of landed nobility who, if provoked, were more than happy to unleash violence upon anything and anyone around them, this order of things offered your only safeguard. The barons were not champions of liberty here. Their power rested on their skills at violence and their ability to commit forces to use violence to uphold and their claim on lands they possessed. Others needed the order of how things were in order to survive. Jews, for example, were incredibly vulnerable. While this king would allow anti-Semitic pogroms happen seemingly with impunity, he also represented the one sliver of protection the Jewish community of England had against ignorant and brutal anti-Semitic nobility. Foreigners, foreign merchants and their families who had found England to be a place of great profit and where they could do well and came to live here, they also feared the more xenophobic ranks of the violent man-tanks who now held the reins of power. And this could explain why some in London were so ambiguous about this. You'd think after all the city had faced, London would be rejoicing in this. And some certainly were. But remember, as I've explained in previous chapters, by default, London preferred to be aligned with the king as protection against the rapacious nobility of England. It had taken decades of ineptitude to drive London to the point where they would side against him. So experience had showed the city that supporting such things could backfire. There was uncertainty about this, even in London. Perhaps this explains away, at least partly, the account of Fitz Thiedmar, the German-born resident of London, whose record of events, Liber de Antiquis Legibus, I've been using so much. Fitz Thiedmar did not like what happened in Oxford, referring to it as the Mad Parliament. And his recording and chronicling of the things that happened in the city display a clear reticence at this turn of events. There is no black and white here, no good or bad. London in 1258 was as morally ambiguous, complex and nuanced as it is in 2024. All was politics. While we are focused on the sins of this nightmare king, he was not alone in sin, and others now had a chance to commit follies on the national stage. Still, reform was now all, and some in London did relish this. And according to the record of Fitz Thiedmar, on July 22nd, with, quote, "His Lordship the King being at Westminster, there came some certain of the 12 barons before mentioned to the Guildhall of London, namely the Earl Marshal, Sir Simon de Montfort, John Fitzgeoffrey, and others, bringing with them a certain charter, to which were appended the seals of many barons, and also the seal of his lordship the king and of his son Edward, who hereby gave their assent, and made oath that they would hold and observe whatever the aforesaid barons should provide for the advantage and amendment of the realm. The persons so sent, putting the mayor and aldermen and others of the city to the question whether they would assert to the provisions so made by them. The mayor, accordingly, and other citizens, who could not obtain leave to speak thereon with his lordship the king, at once holding conference amongst themselves, consented to observe the said provisions, and made an oath to do so, and set the common seal of the city to the charter before mentioned, saving, however, unto them all their liberties and customs," unquote. One could accuse Fitz Thiedmar of painting this moment in a negative light. Would London agree to these new rules and rulers? He makes out that the city wanted to talk to the king first to get his say-so. And given that the pro-royalist John Guisors was mayor at the time, that could actually be true. So there would have been some in the city who were ready to snatch the document up in order to attach their names to it. But there was also probably an ambiguity within the city, summed up with that last line of it. London would support this move, this new body, but their first priority, their principal loyalty, as it had been in the face of the king before, was to the city itself and its rights and liberties. Indeed, within London, we actually think we can work out where the origin of this ambiguity to the new regime stemmed from. Matthew Parrish recorded that, quote, "During all this difficult and important affair, and this new and most happy arrangement of the affairs of the kingdom, Fulk, Bishop of London, was most unbecomingly and uselessly remiss and lukewarm. And by thus acting, he injured his good name the more, because he was more exalted by birth than the rest," unquote. So the Bishop of London was deeply uncertain by this turn of events, and we're left to wonder what he was actually doing to gain such scorn. He clearly wasn't speaking out against the decision in Oxford. He was merely being lukewarm. But that was seen as a political gesture. After all, as Paris says, quote, "As the hopes of the barons rested on him, his weak conduct provoked their anger, as they relied on him to justify the king with the people," unquote. It's clear the new regime expected the Bishop of London to offer support for the provisions of Oxford, and his ambiguity towards it was condemned. Battle lines are being drawn up. And it was clear that the new regime was intending to shake things up. We read that, quote, "Afterwards, the barons before mentioned from day to day held conference together at the new temple, sometimes elsewhere, as to reforming for the better the uses and customs of the realm," unquote. Interesting the location they first used, the headquarters of the Knights Temple. Not in London, not in Westminster. Neutral ground, as always. And it did lead to reforms. Quote, "An edict was published in the city that no one of the king's household, nor any other person, should take anything in the city except at the will of the vendors, saving, however, unto his lordship the king his rightful purchase of wine. And further, that if anyone should presume to contravene the same and be convicted thereof, he should immediately be imprisoned. After this, no one of the king's officers, nor yet any of their people, took anything without soon after paying the vendor for the same," unquote. Now, this is clearly a new law from this committee that had come from within London, and Londoners complaining about how I mentioned a few episodes ago, the king had clearly been sending people out to seize goods. So at least the rapacious excesses of the king's court were being curtailed. However, the record does mention, quote, "This, however, lasted for only a short time," unquote. Of course it did. Nothing is certain in this land of nightmare. And yet, one of the biggest worries was that the genuine fear of the new regime of Bigod, the elected Justiciar of England, would be able to maintain power without fighting. With the war in Wales just kind of being ignored and the Welsh being left unmolested, men in armour still watched everything carefully. For while the king and his son Edward made no overt moves, his in-laws, the Lusignan dynasty, were still around in numbers in the land. And indeed, after leaving Oxford and assembling in Winchester, to the no doubt alarm of the city of London, the Lusignans then gathered in Southwark and the great palace of the Bishop of Winchester there. Their presence caused huge alarm. But in time, they were allowed to leave the country, sailing back across the Channel. But there followed an intense era of great fear about the Lusignans. They were seen still as a danger to many. And in this transitional aftermath, there was a near hysterical air in the nation about them. Rumours abounded that the Lusignans were secretly sending their agents out to poison their enemies all across the kingdom, and there was clearly some kind of behind-the-scenes intrigues going on. The records say down in Dover, the constable intercepted a large sum of cash, supposedly being sent abroad to the Lusignans, And then, quote, at the new temple in London, also, a very large sum was seized, the amount of which excited great astonishment in those who heard of it, and which had been hidden there, unquote. This money supposedly belonged to the Lusignans and was discovered by the new regime, and, quote, this money was taken possession of, to be expended usefully, at the option of the king and the barons, for the benefit of the kingdom, unquote. And, actually, no, wait a minute, back up a second. This is a large sum of cash being held in the headquarters of the Knights Templar. The Templars, who, as I explained back in chapter 68, were the bankers of London. So, a large sum of money being stored in the main bank of London, and apparently it belonged to the French in-laws of the king, and although the records do say the Templars said it wasn't, the powers that be helped themselves to it for the benefit of the kingdom. Is this the first bank robbery in London history? Straight up, did the regime just justify the first ever honest-to-goodness robbery of a bank in London? It kind of feels like it. Ignoring the obvious jokes here, there are two things to take from this little mentioned incident. The first is that the regime of the barons removed money from the Templars' headquarters first. And yes, there will be a significant other fourth withdrawal coming from the Templar headquarters in the future. But secondly, is the idea that there's some kind of phony war of sorts going on, a great wave of paranoia about where the country was going. Matthew Parrish reports that when London agreed to attach the seal of the city to the new charter, quote, they did not intend yet to make public what the resolutions were, for the illness of the Earl of Gloucester, which was caused by a dose of poison, as was commonly reported, seriously alarmed all of them, unquote. Parrish then goes on to say, quote, many of the nobles of England who had been poisoned at the same time, as was said, by the Potivins, began now to pine away in themselves, and some of them departed this life, whilst other noblemen continued lingering twixt life and death, some of them being laymen of rank and power and others men of learning, unquote. There was a belief that the Potivins, the Lusignans, were poisoning everyone. Quote, it was not yet clear to the English that the Potivins had given them the poisonous draughts, for they thought that this disease might proceed from some other calamity and thus show itself openly. There were, moreover, some other evil-disposed poisoners left behind, who were engaged in evil designs and plots against the nobles, in consequence of which the latter entertained suspicions of their caterers, cooks, and butlers, lest they should be bribed to perpetuate similar crimes upon their masters, unquote. This fetid atmosphere of paranoia and fear permeated the land. While the storm promised in the last chapter had broken, it had not been a clean break. From endlessly dealing with the passions of a foolish king, there was now a real sense of threat and growing instability. Parrish says this openly. Quote, the fears and anxieties of the barons were increased by the coming on of the month of July, which, with its plague-bearing lion and furiously raging dog, generally disturbs the repose of the air. What more alarmed them than all the rest was the fickleness and inscrutable duplicity of the king, unquote. 1258 had begun as a year where all London had to deal with was the foolishness of a nightmare king. Now to this we now add his fury at this new regime, the response by the new regime, a genuine nationwide panic caused by the belief that the king's in-laws were running around poisoning their political opponents, and there was a growing fear of conflict, and above all, an ongoing famine not being helped by continual bad weather. With all of this going on, is it any surprise? London's residents reverted to type. They turned to God, and when across England devotional acts of piety and fasting were taking place, as large numbers of subjects began to try and find agency by partaking in these acts, this had an impact on London. Quote, in hearing this, the people of London reproached themselves for their tardiness, and influenced by this example, resolved that a general fast should be imposed upon their religious orders and the citizens and people of that city. That the people of both sexes, observing the due forms of contrition and repentance, should go in procession and offer up devout prayers to the Lord, that he would preserve the fruits of the earth, unquote. The kingdom was still ruled by Henry III, but in reality, he was nothing more than a symbol right now. Edicts were issued in his name by the new baronial regime. the natural order of things had been replaced, and for some, this usurpation of the natural order was seen in the piteous state of the land. And that 1258 was to be a year remembered for, quote, bringing disease and death and heavy storms of wind and rain. Although in the summertime a fair promise of abundant crops of corn and fruit was given, yet in the autumn the continual heavy rain spoiled the corn, fruit and all kinds of pulse. And at the advent of our Lord, in some parts of England, as above stated, the barns remained empty and the crops remained ready to be cut but entirely spoilt. For as the corn shot up, the ear and straw rotted together. And as men died from want of corn, so the cattle died from want of fodder. And though England was drained empty of money on many pretexts, yet the people were obliged at the instigation of hunger to pay 16 shillings for a measure of corn while still moist and shooting, and consequently the poor pined away with hunger and died. The dying staggered away into differing by-places to yield their last wretched breath, and of these was such a great number that the grave diggers were overcome with weariness and threw several bodies into one grave. The people of the middle class, seeing their food failing them, sold their flocks, diminished the number of their household, and left their land uncultivated, whereby all hope of rising from this abyss was entirely extinguished. Had not corn been brought for sale from the continent, there is no doubt but England itself would have perished. Unquote. As historians, we like to focus on the big names in politics. But this sense of crisis, of repeated failed harvests, of continual starvation and death on such a large scale, gives the impression that England was, by all accounts, falling apart of the seams. And in light of this, the actions of the king, of these nightmares and the reaction against him by the landowners feels like the spasms of a polity on the verge of becoming a failed state in all but name. In 1258, we read of reports that the poor of London began fighting over carrion and dead dogs, and they drank the wash that was normally given to pigs. There are claims that 20,000 people died in London alone because of all of this. Could 1259 offer anything better? We'll leave that in the next episode. Thanks for listening. Hope you could enjoy it. Hope you can follow it. And I'll be back next week for another episode in the story of London. Thanks.